This is at least as tough a challenge as marching lots of people to Yorkshire quickly, and much less bracing. He kept his army in the field for longer than Harold could. The only trouble was that it was in the wrong field, and there was a lot of water between it and the right one. It was a change of wind, probably, rather than brilliant strategy, that meant William turned up in late September. It seems likely that he would have crossed earlier if the weather had allowed. Autumn was a much less clement time for starting an important war. Still, it looked like amazing strategy. Not only had he waited for Harold's army to disband, he'd also waited for it, having been called back together, to be force-marched up and down the country, and in the middle of that, required to fight an exhausting battle in which quite a few of it were killed. It seems like inspired waiting around, but it was probably just luck. Bad luck with the weather, turning out to be excellent luck for timing the attack. This luck, which he will have thought meant God was on his side, and logistical excellence, allowed William to plonk a large, well-supplied armed force on the south coast of England. Annoyingly, it's not clear how large, or indeed how large Harold's army was. We can blame medieval chroniclers' rather rhetorical attitude to numbers. They're altogether too keen to say a squillion soldiers to keep the reader's attention. Before you cut those poor oldie-worldie idiots with their childish drawings too much slack, it's worth bearing in mind that they could count. It's not fucking calculus. Someone just needed to tot up the numbers. It would have been nice if they'd bothered. William's army may have numbered anywhere from a few thousand to a few tens of thousands. What seems clearer is that the army Harold scrambled back down the country at the head of and lined up on Senlac Ridge was roughly the same size. All the work they'd both put in, and when it came to it, on the 14th of October 1066, they might as well have tossed a coin. One in the eye for a defensive strategy. Harold didn't win the Battle of Hastings, but he didn't need to in order to stay king. He just had to force a draw. He was in control of England. England was literally and metaphorically behind him. The longer he wasn't comprehensively defeated, the greater the chance William would have to go home. Therefore, his battle tactic was simple. His army would stand at the top of a hill, barring the Normans' advance, and stay there until William gave up. It doesn't sound a very snazzy strategy, but it's how Wellington defeated Napoleon at Waterloo, and basically what happened in almost every single battle on the Western Front. In a sense, Harold was ahead of his time, though he could have really done with a machine gun. As it was, he didn't even have many archers. It's impossible to know how the battle played out, because it happened a long time ago and nobody videoed it. Someone tapestried it, though. Most of our sense of how it went comes from that massive tapestry, the Bayeux Tapestry. You may have heard of it. If you've only heard of one tapestry, it'll be that one. If you've heard of two, I don't know what the other one will be, because personally I've only heard of one. I haven't really even heard of one, because the Bayeux Tapestry is, strictly speaking, an embroidery. I know. Why is it called a tapestry if it's not a tapestry? Why, for that matter, has the fact that it's the most famous object on earth to be referred to as a tapestry not resulted in the definition of the word tapestry being widened to include it? I thought the English language was supposed to be governed by usage rather than arbitrary rules of the kind that have long hobbled French. But then it is a French tapestry. Except it isn't, despite its location and the other part of its name. It's English. It's not a French tapestry, it's an English embroidery. It was commissioned by the victorious Normans, but they didn't have the skill base to commemorate their triumph in needlework, so it was made in England by English women. Another example of how disasters can boost GDP. If you're planning a trip to see a tapestry or embroidery, or indeed any sort of cloth, I recommend the Bayeux Tapestry. If you're passing quite near, it's worth going slightly out of your way for, but it's not Disneyland. Still, I reckon it craps on the Turin Shroud. It really is a massive embroidery. The sense of a vast amount of embroidery done to a very high standard is undeniable, though, as with most medieval art, it looks like it's based on pictures sent in by a 9-year-old Blue Peter competition winner. I can't help wondering whether the undoubtedly talented seamstresses who made it didn't look at each bit as they finished it and noticed this. What do you think, Elf Yifu? I don't think we're getting the faces quite right, and the horses are too small. Jesus Christ, God Yifu, get on with it. We've not got to the actual battle and I'm already bored shitless. Point taken. Initially, it seems the battle was going fine for the Anglo-Saxons. They had the advantage of higher ground, and the cavalry charges of the Normans weren't having much of an impact. The Norman archers were being pretty useless for the amusing reason that there were so few Anglo-Saxon archers to fire arrows back at them that they quickly ran out of arrows. No use shyly walking up to the Anglo-Saxon line to ask if they could have their arrows back. It's an insight into a more environmentally friendly form of warfare than we've had for centuries. Use a bullet once and it's ruined, whether or not it hit anyone. Whereas you can dig an arrow out of your own shoulder and twang it back at the enemy, assuming you're incredibly hard. Just like with single-use plastic, as a society, we need to see single-use bullets as rather an irresponsible way of killing someone. There are lots of musket balls in museums that, in my view, we could seriously look at reusing. Then a rumour went round the Norman army that William had been killed. This caused some of them to start fleeing. At this point, it was all looking pretty good for Harold and co. A section of Harold's army then did the main thing they had been instructed not to do. They charged down the hill after the fleeing Normans. I can almost taste Harold's frustration coming down the centuries about this. I mean, literally, the only thing they had to remember was not to do that. William was gifted the perfect opportunity to show himself to his own side, who were buoyed up by the proof he was alive and then able to kick the living shit out of the pursuing section of the Anglo-Saxon army. Many never got back to the depleted ranks on the ridge. It was so successful that the Normans then used it as a tactic, pretending to flee several times throughout the day, punishing the Anglo-Saxons for their unshakable credulity and grinding down Harold's numbers. The grinding went on for hours and hours until Harold was killed, probably by being shot in the eye with an arrow, though not definitely, at which point the English army collapsed and retreated, with a huge number of the major players in Anglo-Saxon politics left dead on the battlefield. William was lucky to win, but would have been unlucky to lose. That's the thing with coin toss scenarios. However balanced Harold's and William's respective positions before the battle, it was decisive. Anglo-Saxon England was on its knees. At this point, the ghastly nature of Normandy during William's formative years stood him in good stead. He was used to subduing truculent, powerful people. The remaining Anglo-Saxon nobility went down without much of a fight. There was a desultory attempt by the surviving Earls Edwin and Morcar, who hadn't been at Hastings, to rally round the teenage Edgar Atheling. Oh, now you want me to be king, he must have thought. But William spent the rest of the year stalking round London with his army, defeating any forces put up against him, and otherwise wasting the area. This was a savage but effective military strategy at which William excelled, where an army rendered the land unfit to support human life. It didn't take much of this to secure the submission of all the remaining Anglo-Saxon bigshots, at which point William entered London and had himself crowned king at Westminster Abbey on the 25th of December. Merry Christmas. God and my right fist. We've finally got there. It's the setting up of the current English state, key component of the British state. The institution that is the UK today was established 1066, on Christmas Day. It all began with people having to work on a bank holiday. How apt. William the Conqueror wouldn't have expressed it as a beginning. He'd say it was a continuation, a restoration, much as Alfred and Athelstan had presented their own extensions of power a couple of centuries earlier. He would have stressed his legitimate claim as the rightful heir to Edward the Confessor, not a foreign invader at all. The Doomsday Book, the survey of England that William commissioned towards the end of his reign, is full of references to the day on which King Edward was alive and dead. It's a poetic, if long-winded, and those are not mutually exclusive concepts, way of saying the day he died. That day, the Normans insisted, was when William's right to be king began. His regime was nothing more than a lawful continuation of rule from that day, after a regrettable blip caused by the perjuring usurper Harold. But it was a beginning. Nothing illustrates it better than the fact already noted that the numbering of our monarchs starts then. Well, it didn't actually start then. English monarchs weren't issued with their numbers for several centuries. But when the numbering conventions were introduced, it didn't occur to anyone to include any pre-conquest kings in the tally. That's how obvious it seemed to posterity that this was the start of something, not a continuation. Early in William's reign, he made attempts to work with the remains of the pre-Norman aristocracy, but after the first few years had been beset by rebellions, he changed tack. The entire Anglo-Saxon ruling class was replaced by the Norman aristocrats William had brought with him. Ownership of England was passed to new people. That's not something that the legitimacy claim justified. An entire ruling class being dispossessed didn't have anything to do with Edward the Confessor's supposed choosing of William, or Harold's alleged perjury, or the support of the Pope. The premise was possession. We all risked everything to invade, and we might have got killed, but we didn't. We won, and now we're going to enjoy the country we've stolen. They did. To this day, the highest born of the British aristocracy cite Norman ancestry. The Victorians, for all their fondness for Alfred the Great, were obsessed with Norman blood. To have come over with William the Conqueror is as old school as it gets. Aristocratic one-upmanship is all about ancient lines and precedent. Older equals first equals poshest. In theory, anyone who could trace their descent from the Anglo-Saxon nobility would be holding the ace of snobbery trumps, apart from anyone who could say they were descended from, say, Charlemagne or Julius Caesar or Jesus. Quite a few European nobles can claim descent from Charlemagne. The Habsburgs used to claim they were descended from Julius Caesar, but needless to say, it was horseshit. Whatever Dan Brown says, Jesus seems to have ascended to heaven without issue. The Anglo-Saxon nobility were removed and driven into the sort of obscurity where no one's making a note of the genealogy anymore, where the I'm posher than those brutish Normans snobbery doesn't matter. England's most pucker lineage is a descent from thieving thugs. But it's okay because A, they were thieving thugs an exceptionally long time ago, and B, they were extraordinarily successful thieving thugs. We should of course remember that the Anglo-Saxon kings and nobility were also, in all probability, though with a few more mists of time to spare their blushes, descended from thieving thugs. This fascinates me. It seems to be an admission that fundamentally everything's awful. There is no justice, just strength. The foundations of our state, the position of the family whose coat of arms hangs above every courtroom in the land, derives from conquest, militarized theft. The brutal reality of new people in charge and owning everything was quickly evident, and after a few centuries, no longer really denied. I don't say this against the royal family or in a spirit of advocating republicanism. On the contrary, I think the deep-rooted and somehow openly acknowledged hypocrisy of our state's ostensible raison d'etre is kind of great. Dieu est mon droit, God and my right, is the royal motto. But they got everything from a smash and grab. Not just the crown, but pretty much all the land in the country. The right was a dubious claim, to say the least, and the God part, one papal banner notwithstanding, is inferred with hindsight from success. If you get away with it, God was on your side. When someone nicks your mobile phone, remember that. William the Conqueror would have argued that you deserved it because of something sinful you've done. God was with the thief and wanted him to have your property and the lovely heroine he's going to exchange it for. I like all this. I reckon that as soon as anyone starts seriously believing a system of government is at bottom rooted in justice and loveliness, they've let their sceptical guard down and are inviting the unavoidably imperfect to descend into the downright hellish. The world has never been fair and cannot be made fair, and claims that it can are foolish or dishonest. It can be made fairer, and attempts to make it less fair can be resisted. Optimistic realists seek improvement, not perfection. England was invaded and conquered again later, but in all cases, the retrospective justifications said they weren't conquests. Restorations of some sort remain the official story. William tried making it the official story in 1066. That was his one failed endeavour. Nope, it was a conquest, posterity has decided, a takeover by force of arms. There's a sense William was being too modest, saying he was the rightful king aided by God. He was more dynamic than that. Invader, conqueror, successful, sexy asshole. The brilliant son of a bitch nicked the whole place, something which posterity also decided is virtually impossible. That's the presiding mythology, whatever actually happened subsequently. All the invading and toppling, the civil wars and regime changes are blips. England was conquered in 1066, and that's it. That's the line. Everything's been the same since. It was the beginning of English history, and also, in a sense, the end. Part 2. The Dukes of Hazzard. Chapter 14. King William the First. What happened to William the Conqueror in the end? Same as James Bond. He exploded. It's a strange expression, what happened in the end. Looked at from a historical point of view, it implies that the final thing to happen is what happened overall. It was the most important, the defining thing. But life doesn't have a tournament structure. For a mortal species, to focus on what happened last is a pretty downbeat way of looking at things. In the end, we die. But that's not necessarily the main thing about us. Still, our ends often overshadow us. History bristles with examples of people who died in poverty despite being great artists or musicians or having invented vulcanized rubber. The penurious demise casts a pall over their achievements. It can make their efforts seem futile. Those people get defined by the injustice of fate. Similarly, when the people meeting grisly ends are nasty, we can feel that justice has been done. But that doesn't make sense either. What happened to Adolf Hitler in the end was no less than he deserved, but it didn't restore justice. It didn't make everything okay. I wasn't expecting to find out what happened to James Bond in the end. He's not real. He doesn't have to end or begin. There's no need to make those things part of the story. So imagine my surprise when, tentatively venturing out to the cinema in post-lockdown London for the relaxing escapism of a Bond movie, at finding myself, spoiler alert, watching that character die. I was fucking furious. I'd looked forward to that night out. We'd been to Pizza Express first. We'd had popcorn and chocolate buttons brought to our seats at a swanky cinema. And then, at the very end of No Time to Die, James Bond is killed in an explosion. Yes, he actually dies, in the middle of a pandemic, when death was feeling really unoriginal. I'm sorry if this is where you're finding that out, but it's one of the most extraordinary creative missteps that Hollywood money has ever been lavished on. James Bond not dying is the premise of a Bond film. It's the premise of the whole franchise. What you are supposed to watch and enjoy is the exciting manner in which he does not die. The fact that a movie that departs from this sound convention was deemed by many reviewers to be clever or interesting or dark or real, to be, in summary, good and indeed better than the ones where he doesn't die, is an index of how mediocre, joyless and self-importantly worthy our commentariat has become. Honestly, the whole creative team, right up to Barbara Broccoli and Daniel Craig, need to be lined up against a wall and criticised. Better still, they should have to answer to the ghost of Ian Fleming, who met his own death, having left his famous creation alive and wisecracking. He must have thought the lovable rogue was safe. But no, the daughter of one of the producers to whom he'd sold the film rights had another idea. She was going to leave him, depressed and alone, contemplating the fact that he'd never see his own daughter again. Oh yes, he's been turned into a family man by then, while some Royal Navy cruise missiles bear inexorably down on him. You may be thinking that there's more about James Bond in this chapter than you expected. Sorry, but my point is that giving Bond a sad and lonely end casts a shadow over every other moment in his life that we've seen portrayed. It's a proper canonical Bond film, so that simply is what happened to him. That's the story, and pretending it isn't would be like reading a Poirot novel, but determining to believe a different solution to the mystery than the one provided by the detective. There's no getting away from the fact that everything Bond undergoes in every other film, every moment of suavity, action, humour or seduction, is happening to a man destined to die young, heartbroken and alone. This lamentable situation is further complicated, and I promise I will get back to the Kings of England in a minute, by the words put on screen at the end of the credits. James Bond will return. This is a tradition of the franchise, like James Bond not dying. But what can it mean here? Clearly, the producers are keen to keep the gravy train fully serviced for another journey. But will this be a prequel from earlier in Bond's life, so another film overshadowed by the knowledge of his bleak demise? Or will it turn out that he didn't die after all, in which case they have released a Bond film where, for the first time, they elected not to end with the exciting, heroic and miraculous nature of his triumph, but with a miserable and vacuous affectation of artistic significance, which they will then reveal to have been a sort of leaden prank. Either way, the shit ending really spoils it. It's the same with William the Conqueror. At least that was fate, not a creative choice. His bowels exploded while some monks in Caen were trying to cram his bloated corpse into a sarcophagus that was far too snug for him. The consequent stench rather ruined the solemnity of the remaining funeral rites. So that was the very last anyone saw of him. The bit before that wasn't much more dignified. The bloating which necessitated the sarcophagus cramming had partly happened pre and partly post-mortem. William had put on a bit of weight in his declining years, which is not how one imagines the victor of the Battle of Hastings. There's a glum poignancy to it, a sign of mundane human frailty which undermines the snapshot image of the victorious warrior. Suddenly you imagine a cross and red-faced old fat guy, from divinely inspired warrior to compulsively snacking gammon. If he does have that altercation with Henry VIII in the afterlife, it might be a closer fight than I first imagined, like a couple of aging regal sumo wrestlers. It all depends on what system the afterlife has for the corporeal manifestations of its inmates. Are they in their prime, or how they were when they expired, or how most people think of them? This would hugely influence how a King Bill versus King Harry punch-up might go, as well as raising other, more philosophical questions about what the hell is going on generally. These rulers' bodily frailty reminds me of Napoleon's piles. They stopped him being able to ride a horse at the Battle of Waterloo. He was a brilliant general, an administrator of unparalleled energy, a ruthless tyrant, and a politician of dazzling opportunism. But he was also a portly chap who, on the day his fate was decided, was mainly thinking about his sore ass. If he's in the same afterlife as Kenneth Williams, maybe he can lend the Emperor a tube of Anasol. In 1087, William, by then nearly 60, set off on a military expedition against King Philip I of the Franks, basically France, but it isn't called that yet. William, in defiance of his age and obesity, was attacking the town of Mantes and really got stuck in. And then, in turn, the pommel of his horse's saddle got stuck in him, right in his new enormous stomach. It caused a horrific injury, and the best medical advice at the time was just to settle in for a long, agonising death. William had himself taken to a priory outside Rouen and proceeded to do so. When he finally expired, and all the important people had legged it to try and secure their futures under whatever the new regime turned out to be, his attendants stripped the room and corpse of anything of value and then fled. There lay the conqueror, naked and alone and beginning to decompose. Bleak. A fairly lowly knight had to arrange for the body to be transported the 80 miles from Rouen to Caen, where William had said he wanted to be buried, in one of the monasteries he founded. This was the only element of the funeral that went as he would have wanted. It was marred first by fire in the town, then by a weird heckling incident when a member of the congregation claimed the church had been illegally built on his family's land, and then finally by the aforementioned royal bowel bursting. That's what happened to him in the end. The language barrier and other barriers. There's a lot of discussion among historians about how radically the Norman conquest changed England. The problem with it being historians having the discussion rather than, say, scientists, is that historians aren't very good at measuring things. Scientists would say that if you're working out the extent of anything, the first thing you need is an objective way of measuring it, in this case of measuring the level of radicalness of a change. They would come up with an SI unit for that, and then we could put a number on the effect of the Norman conquest and compare it to, say, the level of radicalness of change wrought by the Russian Revolution, or voyages of Christopher Columbus, or the invention of the soda stream. All historians have is words, adjectives and the like, small, huge, fundamental, superficial, and phrases, not as huge as has been previously thought, much more significant than was suggested by recent orthodoxy, etc. What historians say happened is often just stated in comparison to what other historians previously said happened, rather than in comparison to not knowing what happened at all. The reason there's controversy about something which, it seems to me, we could all agree caused reasonably major changes is that historians' prejudices about each other start to play a part. This is because the section of society for whom the Norman conquest was indisputably a massive deal was the ruling class. Historians who conclude that the conquest caused an enormous change are suspected of only caring about the fate of posh people out of either snobbery or laziness. Snobbery because they're only interested in the lives and fates of kings and earls and so on, and laziness because such people leave a lot more in the way of written records and statues and buildings, so it's much easier to keep track of what they're up to than it is with your average peasant or slave. Yes, slave. It seems incongruous, doesn't it, in the Middle Ages? There were still quite a lot of slaves in England in the late 11th century. Not serfs, not merely peasants whose freedoms were, by modern standards, massively curtailed, but proper, full-on, how much will you take for that big strong lad with a lazy eye, slaves, like the Romans had. It seems it was the one major aspect of Roman civilization that the Anglo-Saxons really took to. Funny people. The Normans were comparatively anti-slavery, not so much as to actively ban it. According to the Domesday Book, over 10% of the population in 1086 were slaves. But William did ban the sale of English slaves overseas, which stymied the export market, and under the influence of the Norman aristocracy, the practice went into decline. By around 1200, there weren't any. So it might not have been so bad for normal people, say some historians to some other historians, as it was for the Anglo-Saxon aristocrats with whom you're obsessed, even though they don't matter as much as millions of poor people and crop yields. And it may well be that for lots of the ordinary peasantry, the Norman conquest didn't make all that much difference, and very little appreciable negative difference, particularly as William adopted the long-established Anglo-Saxon governmental and administrative system, the one Ethelred had managed not to destroy, and the Canutes hadn't tinkered with, and which was still in pretty good nick. England was, by the standards of the time, a nice, orderly kingdom to take over, like a house you move into where the fuses are clearly labelled. Frankly, that infrastructure was why a project like William's much-vaunted Domesday Book was possible at all. Still, it's hard to believe the peasantry didn't notice the new management. For one thing, it spoke a different language. Old English, the language of the Anglo-Saxons, ceased to be used by the nobility or in the administration of the kingdom. It was replaced by Latin and Norman French, and all but disappeared as a written language. This is a world away from leaders just having a posh accent. The subtly different way people such as David Cameron pronounce words like round and pound, even from other people with RP, makes us suspect that they're a slightly different sort of human from most of those they seek to govern. But imagine if, instead, old Etonian cabinet ministers simply spoke French. Even that would make them seem too familiar. Most of us learned some French at school or have visited France. It would be like all our political leaders were suddenly speaking Hungarian or Japanese. This situation was not short-lived. Royalty and aristocracy in England continued to use a different language from the vast majority of the people for centuries. English, Middle English rather than Old English by that point, didn't become the official language of the English courts until 1362, or of government until the reign of Henry V in the early 15th century. Its legacy is that in modern English we often have words for the meats we eat that are different from those for the animals they come from. Beef for cow, pork for pig, and mutton for sheep. This isn't out of delicacy, an attempt to conceal what docile creatures slaughter any given lunch has necessitated. It's because, in the Middle Ages, only rich people ate meat, and, after the Norman conquest, all the rich people spoke French. The French words for the animals, bœuf, porc, mouton, turned into the words for the foods, and the English words came to refer to the animals under the only circumstances where the peasantry encountered them, when looking after them until they were ready to be turned into posh people's dinner. Another change that even the least posh must have noticed was the appearance of castles. I don't mean a change in what the castles looked like. I mean they appeared. There were no castles, and then, pretty suddenly, there were castles. The notion of castles being new is weird. Perhaps young people today feel the same about CDs. Obviously, fortification wasn't new. There'd been forts in the Iron Age, and the Romans built thousands of them, and the Anglo-Saxons developed fortified towns, known as burhs, as a way of defending against the Vikings. But castles as structures controlled by the local lord or by the crown, as nodes for the imposition of power on the surrounding land and settlements, came with the Normans. Literally, they brought wooden ones as flat packs in their invasion fleet. Overconfident bastards. Castles had existed on the continent for about 200 years, and the Normans saw them as key to exerting control over the new country they'd stolen. They stuck up wooden ones everywhere, 500 of them in 20 years, usually overlooking towns and villages. The standard design was a defensive central building, the keep, plonked on a little hill, which was often man-made, called a motte. This word is confusing, because the castle would also have a moat, which went downwards, while a motte went up. I suppose you could make a motte by digging a moat. That's how sandcastles work. Next to the motte, and within the moat, was something called a bailey, which was a walled courtyard with a palisade around it, and other castle stuff, kitchen, chapel, chill-out room, etc., inside it. These are known by historians as motte and bailey castles, in willful disregard of the fact that the moat and keep are the more interesting features. These wooden castles were gradually converted to stone, which is why we have so many lovely ruined ones to walk round today. And in the case of the Tower of London and Windsor Castle, some lovely ones that the Victorians restored to how they reckoned history should have looked. You know, nice and tidy. Unjust William. None of this gives an answer to the most pertinent question about the Norman Conquest from our point of view. How should we feel about it? The historian's answer is unhelpful. They say we should feel differently from previous historians. They always say that. It's relentless, mild revisionism and is therefore endlessly comparative. The conquest mattered more/less, was better/worse than was previously thought. But what does that mean? As you know, at Hastings, I'm on Harold's side, like most British schoolboys. But after that, the narrative of school history changes. Suddenly, there's a lot of look at the lovely castles, Norman architecture in churches, curved non-pointed arches are the thing to look for. Strangely, the Norman stuff looks more modern than the Gothic architecture that came later. And the ruddy Doomsday Book. Let's be honest, the Doomsday Book is not that impressive. It's just a manky old book, or rather two manky old books. An ancient pile of incomplete paperwork about what England was like. No one in the last 300 years is genuinely going to be wowed by that. Not instinctively or viscerally. I get more bump from my financial advisor on an annual basis. Durham Cathedral is impressive. The Doomsday Book is some rotting jottings. The reason the Doomsday Book is relentlessly cited as so bloody amazing is twofold. First, it's very useful for researching what was going on in post-conquest England. If your job is doing that, it's impossible not to feel grateful for this resource. You'd get fond of it. I feel the same about Google Maps. And second, because in explaining why it is supposedly amazing, you end up illustrating the nature of the era quite effectively, but without being overtly negative. This was a time, everyone gets told and it's right, when producing this fairly modest bit of national analysis and research was a huge achievement. This did not happen by accident. The king must have really wanted this because at this stage of history, being this organised, even briefly, was extremely unusual. It's an upbeat way of making clear what we're dealing with. Quite a primitive society. England may have been more administratively sophisticated than most places in Europe, but by modern standards, that's not saying much. There's still a lot of fighting in the mud and no opera. But was it worse than what went before? It was for Northerners. The Doomsday Book makes that clear with all its references to the areas of waste in Yorkshire. This was a result of something called the Harrying of the North, which feels like it should be called the Williaming of the North, or possibly the Willying of the North, because it certainly left the North well and truly fucked. It happened in the winter of 1069-70, and it was William's response to various uprisings in northern England in support of Edgar Atheling, who was on the comeback trail. The North was different, and William knew it. The influence of the Danes was still strong there, and the late Anglo-Saxon kings had never had as firm a grasp over it as they had over Wessex and Mercia. When putting together his rebellion, Edgar Atheling had appealed for support to King Sweyn II of Denmark, who was a nephew of Canute, the man who had wrested England from Edgar's grandfather, Edmund Ironside. It all feels like they're trying to get a pre-Norman gang together, and in 1069, Edgar and the Danes briefly occupied York. You can understand why William completely lost his shit over this. He didn't know that post-Norman conquest, the whole Anglo-Danish thing was over. It was only 3 years since he'd seized the kingdom from a very tenacious Anglo-Danish usurper, from William's point of view. Like all English kings, he will have feared a Danish threat like the modern Germans fear hyperinflation. But by the time William got to York with an army, Edgar had fled to the court of King Malcolm III of Scotland, and the Danes were back in their ships. William had been denied battle, so he paid off the Danes. It's confusing that while this was often a disastrous strategy, successful kings like William and Alfred the Great seemed to get away with it, and decided to waste the North. His troops went around slaughtering people and burning villages, crops and crop stores. The hope was that the area would no longer be able to support the king's enemies. The side effect was that it was unable to support much human life at all. Some historians say this was an act of genocide, others that it was merely the sort of brutal thing that went on back then. I don't reckon those conclusions are mutually exclusive, but it underlines William's ruthlessness. He'd had a tough upbringing, inheriting the dukedom as an illegitimate minor and being passed from magnate to magnate in an anarchic power struggle. Before he'd conquered England, he'd had to conquer what was nominally his own duchy. This took strength and the projection of strength. I'm not saying he'd become a psychopath numbed by trauma, but he wasn't the sort of person who, if they see a lamb gambling across a field, turns veggie for 6 months. His mercilessness may have been the quality that was most vital to his success. Doubt is a dangerous thing in medieval politics. We've seen how doubt over the line of succession bred violence and discord, and we're going to keep seeing that. That's going to get boring. A key skill in a medieval ruler is eliminating doubt, and ruthlessness is part of that. The knowledge that, if crossed, the king will respond with immediate reflex savagery, no matter who is doing it or why, is in a sense reassuring. It reassures you that any rebels who might disturb the peace will be dealt with quickly, so you don't have to worry about lawlessness in the land. Plus, if you're a senior baron thinking of rebelling yourself, it reassures you that there's no point. You're not being a mug by not tilting at the throne, or supporting someone else who might and who would give you great honours if they succeeded with your help. You don't have to fret about whether or not to rebel, because you know it's definitely not worth the risk. That's clear. Everyone knows who's in charge and can relax. While looked at one way, the harrying of the North makes William a genocidal maniac, it also demonstrates his understanding of the contemporary rules of ruling. He knew that it was impossible to make it too clear that rebelling and consorting with the Danes of all people was not okay. This clarity banished doubt. Still, if Harold had been king, things might well have been calmer. There's no reason to think he wouldn't have dealt with rebellion just as ruthlessly. He also seemed to have a strong grasp of what constituted professionalism in a ruler of the time. But he wouldn't have had so much dissent to deal with, because he would broadly have been governing with the consent of England's Anglo-Saxon ruling class. There wouldn't have been as much harrying, more appropriately named in his case, needed, which would have made for a nicer time for most people. I think that's my conclusion about the Norman conquest. It was a moderately major change, and in general for people at the time, it would have been nicer if it hadn't happened. I feel the same way when they make you upgrade your operating system. I don't want to dwell on this, because we're now stuck for several centuries with this French-speaking, castle-dwelling ruling class who perpetually have half an eye on what's happening in France. Some would say we're still stuck with them. We might as well try and enjoy them. Children of the New Forest. Do you have a favourite holiday destination? Perhaps somewhere you associate with sunshine and childhood. Cornwall or the Lake District or North Wales. Maybe sunshine is pushing it. Drizzle and ice cream. Personally, I'm fond of the New Forest. I've had many happy times there with my family. Glamorously enough, it turns out this is something I have in common with the English royal family of the 11th century. William the Conqueror's brood loved the New Forest. They really did. In fact, it was William who, in around 1079, proclaimed it a royal forest, which is what it remained until it became a national park in 2005. They spent a huge amount of time there. In fact, they had a little place down there. It was called the New Forest. Just when you're thinking that you might be able to get a handle on these strange people because you've found something about them that you recognise other than the need to eat and oxygenate blood, in this case that they liked the New Forest, it only turns to greater weirdness. William had four sons and two of them were killed in the New Forest. In hunting accidents, of course. But not in the same hunting accident. William's second son, Richard, was killed there in 1070, and his third, William Rufus, in 1100. This means, and this is what I reckon is weird, even for someone who would give the North such a vigorous harrying, that they kept going there. It didn't spoil it for them, as a family, the fact that one of them had been killed there. It didn't then have negative, one might hazard, traumatic associations. There wasn't then something about that area that didn't feel quite so fun. These are people who had a wide range of other recreational options, by which I mean other places they could have gone hunting, because they certainly weren't going to do anything except hunting. But oh no, they reckoned they'd stick with the New Forest. Ah well, we've all got to go sometime, it's still a lovely forest, was the view. Like learning to be impressed by the Doomsday Book, these very different family attitudes are a good illustration of how alien this time was. Royal nuclear families back then were not close in the modern sense. They often treated each other with open contempt, if not open warfare. William had seven children who outlived him, four daughters and three sons. The eldest son, Robert, had a troubled relationship with his father, which started with William giving him the nickname Curthose, meaning short stockings. If this was ever meant affectionately, the name outlived the affection. Robert first rebelled against his father at the age of about 16 as a result of an occasion when his two surviving younger brothers, William Rufus and Henry, emptied a full chamber pot on his head. Genuinely. I mean, they didn't know about germs, but still, one gets the sense that these people weren't just literally shitty. At the end of the ensuing unhygienic brawl, King William failed, in Robert's view, to sufficiently punish the two whippersnappers for befouling him, so he flounced off and tried to storm one of his father's castles. Unsuccessfully. Despite this shaky start, rebelling became a bit of a hobby for Robert, and he had a rackety time for the rest of his father's life. His mother, Queen Matilda, was keener on him than his dad was, and, to William's fury, was discovered to be secretly sending her son money. She brokered a rapprochement between the two of them at Easter 1080, but they fell out again soon after her death in 1083. By the time William was lying in a priory with a suppurating wound and nothing left on his to-do list except divide up his lands, die and explode, he was on the verge of disinheriting his eldest son. England certainly would go to William Rufus, his favourite child. However, the Norman lords pushed for Robert to inherit the duchy as planned. That's what William had declared more than once previously, and Normandy, unlike England at this stage, had a firm tradition of primogeniture dating back to Rollo. In a spirit of banishing peace-corroding doubt, the dying duke relented and left his ancestral lands to Robert after all. His youngest surviving son, Henry, just got money. This was a flawed outcome. Robert, while easygoing and affable, when not furious with his father, seems also to have been lazy, inconsistent, relentlessly impecunious, and generally unlucky. William Rufus was made of sterner stuff. Meanwhile, many major lords held lands in both Normandy and England and didn't want to have to choose between the two. Robert, some nobles will have thought, was likely to be a soft touch. They were probably right, and he always needed money, which left him open to persuasion. But weak figures like that are enormous purveyors of doubt, the very thing William the Conqueror was trying to avoid by giving him the duchy, and I'll say it again, doubt, particularly doubt about the future conduct of the ruler, is the greatest obstacle to the barons of a medieval kingdom having a nice quiet life. That is what I am resolutely insisting most people wanted. Some say that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. I find that an awkward principle because, in my view, allowing good men to do nothing is the purpose of civilization. Chapter 15. King William II. I don't mean to get into the habit of starting each chapter explaining how the ruler it's about died. Nevertheless, I've already mentioned this, so there's no suspense to be ruined. William II died in 1100 as a result of a hunting accident in the New Forest. Some say it was no accident, but some say it was an accident. I reckon it's too late to dust for Prince, so that's where this is all heading. He was known as William Rufus. Rufus means red-headed, so it was probably because he had red hair or was ruddy-cheeked. Either way, it feels fonder than Curthose. He was unmarried and died without issue, and he has gone down in history as quite a bad king. Not the worst, but not one of the good guys. And the good guys, on closer examination, usually turn out to have killed more people than Fred West and blinded more than dogshit. Why the dodgy reputation? I must say I don't entirely understand it. The chroniclers of the time say he did terrible things. Embezzled from the church, allowed his entourage to steal from local villages when his court was progressing round the country, failed to appoint a new Archbishop of Canterbury so he could keep the money, etc. He eventually did appoint a new archbishop because he fell ill and assumed this was because God was cross with him. So in 1093, he picked Archbishop Anselm to take the place of Archbishop Lanfranc, who died in 1089 and was himself the replacement for the Anglo-Saxon Stigand, whom I mentioned earlier. That's three archbishops in a row whose names ended in interesting juxtaposed consonants. Coincidence? Well, it means you have to pronounce them carefully. Reverently even, to do justice to the last noise. It's a technique branding experts must be aware of. I'm sure that's where Haagen-Dazs came from. I'm thinking of sticking an extra N on the end of my own name in the hope of finally getting a bit of bloody respect. Back to William's detractors. They also said, and obviously this was a scandalous accusation for the time, that he was gay. They didn't put it like that, of course. People at the time said William indulged in the sin of sodomy and encouraged effeminacy in his followers. They said William did that sin lots, which was very bad of him, and meant he was a terrible king who deserved to die young in a hunting accident. We don't know if he was gay or bisexual, or if the various forms of sexual abandon that he's accused of actually happened. Maybe it was just that he was mean to the church, and so the chroniclers, all of whom lived in monasteries, accused him of sodomy to sully his reputation. But where would they have got the idea from, living in a monastery? At this time, almost all rulers found themselves at loggerheads with ecclesiastical authorities because of an ongoing international row about whether the Pope or local kings got to appoint bishops. It was possible to represent any of them as enemies of the church, so it doesn't feel like it means much. My scepticism about whether he deserves his bad reputation stems from two things. First, the uncalamitous character of his reign. Most of the kings who we're encouraged to think of as bad demonstrably screwed things up. Ethelred the Unready, as we've already seen, and also Stephen, John, Edward II, Richard III, whom we have yet to enjoy. The shit hit the fan in all of those cases, and there was no hiding it. But William II seems to have ruled with competence. He inherited England under controversial circumstances. Many powerful noblemen wanted England and Normandy reunited, and at the beginning of the reign, they didn't see William as the man to do it. In 1088, there was a major rebellion led by his uncle, Bishop Odo of Bayeux, in favour of Robert Curthose. Rufus dealt efficiently with this and all future rebellions. He expanded England's borders at the expense of Scotland to include Cumberland and Westmoreland, secured the border with Wales with a string of castles, and by the end of his reign he had effectively become Duke of Normandy too, thus reuniting his father's empire in the opposite way to that envisaged by Bishop Odo. This last was thanks to his brother's relentless incompetence and need for money. Robert leased the duchy to William for 10,000 marks, which paid for him to go on the First Crusade. You're going to be hearing a lot about these crusades over the next few hundred years, and I'll get into them in more detail later. At this point, suffice it to say that it involved fighting in the Middle East, and Robert went on it, and it was the best place for him. So unless you listen to all the anecdotal evidence about church funding and followers stealing things, all of which could have happened during most reigns, Williams appears to be a functional regime. This leads me to the second reason for my scepticism, which is related to his possible sexuality. It's the fact that he died without issue. Nobody afterwards was motivated to look after his reputation. Many subsequent kings were careful to honour William the Conqueror's name and the righteousness of his rule because they were his descendants and their rights rested on his. But no subsequent regime derived its legitimacy from William Rufus, so his reputation remained an easy target for chroniclers with nits to pick. William seems, in general, to have had the strength, consistency, energy, ruthlessness, and organisational competence required to keep fractious possessions together. He wasn't the best of medieval kings, but neither was he one of the many who simply couldn't do the job. On the other hand, sorry to be annoying and not come to a firm overall conclusion about William II. I'm really hoping it wasn't merely the prospect of a firm overall conclusion about William II that convinced you to listen to this book. But I'm afraid there is another way of looking at it. His reign was only 13 years long and might even have ended in someone murdering him. Whether or not it did, there's a chance that the collapse of government that I just said was absent from Rufus's maligned regime was imminent. The other, more disastrous kings I mentioned, Ethelred and co., all, with the exception of Richard III, reigned longer than William II before everything fell to bits for them. So his reign could have been an unbearable tyranny, or it could have been perfectly fine. We can relax when making our judgment because, refreshingly, William himself didn't seem to care what anyone thought at all. He didn't care what posterity thought, what his subjects thought, and, except when dangerously ill, what his boss thought. By his boss, I mean God. William certainly acknowledged no other, and he barely acknowledged him. In this, he was very different from his father. William the Conqueror was very religious. As we've seen, by our standards, everyone was back then, and there's no suggestion that William Rufus was anything close to an atheist, but he wasn't pious. His father, on the other hand, really was. Tediously so. It was key to how he coped psychologically with an existence fraught with danger and risk. He'd had to fight all his life, and at the few points where he didn't have to fight, he'd chosen to fight. He will have been bitterly aware, from Harold's fate if nothing else, how a stray arrow could make everything suddenly go wrong. For him, religion was the answer. William Rufus wasn't like that. He wasn't naturally God-fearing, and he wasn't a generous endower of the church. Very unusually for the time, the most enduring architectural legacy of his reign isn't religious but secular. It's not even a castle. It's Westminster Hall, still part of the Palace of Westminster today. It's an impressive building, though the best thing about it is the hammer beam roof, and that was put in 3 centuries later. And it was the largest hall in Europe at the time. In a sense, that makes it a precursor of the Shard, though I earnestly hope that isn't still standing in 930 years' time. For William to dedicate that much stonemasonry to neither war nor God shows bravado. He was a bluff military type, full of regal and martial self-confidence. There's a story about him needing to hurry to France in 1099 because the city of Le Mans in the county of Maine had fallen. When he heard the news, he was hunting in the New Forest, obviously, but headed directly for Le Mans. So directly, in fact, that he reportedly had a wall demolished that was in the way, to make some sort of point, one imagines, as I'm sure it would have been quicker to walk round it. When he arrived at Southampton, there was only an extremely rickety ship available, and the weather didn't look too clever. The sailors counselled caution, but William said, "I have never heard of a king who was drowned at sea." He commanded them to set sail, which they did, and all was well, until the following year when he was killed hunting in the New Forest. This attitude is the opposite of pious or God-fearing. As William the Conqueror nervously waited on the French coast for a favourable wind to invade England, one suspects that he considered the drowning of a king, or a duke as he then was, to be eminently possible if you put God in a bad mood. His son, meanwhile, felt that there was something about him, something physiologically different, that made him undrownable. That's the difference a generation can make. What William II had, and it can be both a strength and a weakness, was a sense of entitlement. Was this entitlement the reason he never troubled to marry and beget an heir? It's a very unusual choice for a monarch at this time, and the suspicion that he was gay isn't enough to explain it. Royal marriages weren't usually love matches. The business of impregnation could generally be managed within couples where there was no mutual attraction. Even the most undutiful of kings still tended to try to provide an heir, unless there was already an obvious successor. Athelstan, the great Anglo-Saxon king, had no wife or children, and some people think that may have been a deliberate diplomatic omission because of all the younger half-brothers, all considered Athelings, who were lining up behind him. The introduction of an infant heir into that dynastic context would have been destabilising. But that concern isn't applicable to Rufus's situation. Robert Curthose was his nominal heir, as he was Curthose's, but William showed no desire for his elder brother and his progeny to inherit England. He probably expected to outlive him anyway. After that, what was the plan? Was William so entitled he thought he'd never die? Or did he just not care? If the latter is true, he is an extremely unusual monarch. In general, they all care about who will succeed them. They obsess over that, as if by getting it right they become immortal. You're probably aware of the lengths Henry VIII later went to in order to father a son. That need changed the whole country's religion and geopolitical orbit in a way that still partially defines Britain today. Henry also had a healthy sense of entitlement, but for him, the notion of leaving no ordered male succession was nightmarish. That's because he believed there was something bigger and more important than him. The crown, God, the dynasty, all that. William II doesn't seem to have given a shit about any of it. And who are we to say that was wrong? Chapter 16. King Henry I. If William II had a sense of entitlement, Henry I suffered from imposter syndrome. That was because he was an imposter. If Rufus was murdered, his younger brother Henry, or someone working on his behalf, is a major suspect. Even if his predecessor wasn't murdered, Henry still usurped the throne. William II had left it to Robert Curthose, albeit unenthusiastically. For the second time, Robert would have expected to be King of England, but he was still on crusade, and Henry moved fast. He rode from the New Forest, oh yes, he was right there when William was killed, to Winchester, where he seized the royal treasury, and then to Westminster, where he had himself crowned king 3 days later. He had to make do with the Bishop of London officiating, because Archbishop Anselm was in exile over a quarrel with William, but it still counted. Only a few centuries after the Byzantines started making this shit up, coronations were now viewed as real and sacred and transformative. Once you were crowned and anointed, you simply were the king. That was the view. Maybe you shouldn't be the king, but you still were. That's why in those days no one hung about being uncrowned for months, though the ceremony could be nicely organised with lots of pageantry. It wasn't worth the risk of a rival claimant steaming in with some biddable bishop and getting himself crowned while the rightful ruler was busy choosing bunting. Even though Henry wasn't the rightful heir, by getting crowned he had sort of physically become a king, and that was, to a certain extent, that. Robert Curtos could still fight to remove him, but he was fighting to remove an anointed king, not a hopeful prince, and that felt very different. It's still the situation with Roman Catholic priests. Once someone is ordained a priest, that's that. They can say the Mass, they have the power of transubstantiation, whatever happens. If they're disgraced, imprisoned, or lose their faith, there's nothing the Church can do, it thinks, to reverse the transformation that occurred in them when they were ordained. So stealing the crown isn't just like stealing an object, say a crown, something that can then be returned to its rightful owner. It's like stealing a sandwich and then eating it. The delicious sandwichy goodness of royalty was within Henry, no matter what Robert did. Still, you can understand the imposter syndrome. He knew he wasn't supposed to be king, and this is only made clearer by the comical nature of his claim to the throne. Henry cited something called porphyrogeniture. Unlike primogeniture, which gives primacy to the firstborn, porphyrogeniture favours those born in the purple. The word comes from the Greek porphyrogenitos, meaning purple-born. The purple in question is Tyrian purple, the expensive dyed cloth customarily worn by Roman emperors. This is another example of medieval kings borrowing some Roman notions they'd vaguely heard about to try and make themselves seem posh. The idea behind porphyrogeniture was that even better than being the firstborn male of the previous king was being born while your father was already king, in the purple. It feels tied in with the notion of kingship causing a physical change in the human who becomes king. Henry was claiming that he was more royal than Robert Curtos because William the Conqueror was already King of England when Henry was born, whereas when Robert was born, and William Rufus for that matter, he was a mere Duke of Normandy. To me, this idea seems so mad and self-serving as to have barely been worth Henry expressing. It might as well have been people whose names begin with H-ogeniture. He stuck with the theory, though, and since he was unmarried at the time of his accession, both of his legitimate children were born in the purple too. The more societally useful consequence of Henry's imposter syndrome was his coronation charter. Fundamentally, this was a deal he was offering the leading nobility. It was mainly stuff about not charging exorbitant fees when a son inherited his father's lands and not forcing rich widows to remarry, the sort of thing the barons got stressed about. But the key message was, I will be a reasonable king. Much more so than my brother, more like my father. I offer peace and justice, was the pitch. Like Magna Carta over a century later, this charter was an influential document and much cited in later decades when the barons were disappointed with the quality of kingship they were receiving. The surprising thing was that, broadly speaking, Henry, the maybe fratricidal, definitely usurper, was as good as his word. He kept that promise and his reign was stable and successful. Frankly, he was a born king. Except he wasn't, unless you're a believer in porphyrogeniture. And if you are a believer in that, I bet I can guess what job your dad had when you were born. He was a natural. From a modern perspective, he was right to seize the throne, because he was very good at being king. Being cruel to be king. Henry was good at being king, but that's not to say he was good. By modern standards, he was horrible. Vicious and brutal and vengeful. But his reign in England, after a brief, inevitable and unsuccessful attempt by Robert Curtos to claim the throne in 1101, was peaceful. There was a flurry of punitive violence against the lords who had supported Robert, and then calm. If medieval England had been a democracy and all of its kings had been options on a ballot paper, all normal members of the public and the overwhelming majority of aristocrats would have been well advised to vote for Henry I. Under him, England was a placid and administratively efficient place to live, where conditions in general were improving. Why? He was predictable. That's the key. It's disappointing in a lover, but in a feudal overlord it hits the spot. Henry made it clear what the deal was, what he wanted and what he expected, and then he was reasonable if he got it, and horrendous if he didn't. Like his father, he eliminated doubt. He did it even more effectively than his father, but then he didn't have to conquer a kingdom. He did have to conquer a dukedom, though. Most influential Anglo-Norman lords at this point still held land in both England and Normandy, and their wealth was always jeopardised by the possibility that the two regimes in which it was held might have a war with each other. After Henry's coronation, Curtos, who was on his way back from the First Crusade, remained Duke of Normandy. William II had only leased the dukedom, and by primogeniture and the bequests of both William I and William II, the wills of both wills, Robert was the rightful duke. He was also the rightful King of England, until Henry persuaded him to give up his claim at the Treaty of Alton in 1101 in exchange for 3,000 marks of silver a year. This was a lot of money, but it was still a good deal for Henry. And Robert frittered the cash away anyway. As I've already mentioned, he was one of those people who simply cannot hold on to money. He was constantly broke despite his ability to get hold of vast sums. Some people can work their way through any amount. For all our sakes, may Jeff Bezos be blessed with such an heir. Henry had Normandy off Curtos within a few years. Curtos wasn't a total idiot, and had fought well in the First Crusade, but his financial failings were part of a wider propensity to cock things up. Henry was pushing against an open door. He sowed a bit of discord in Normandy, and by 1106 many of the Norman barons were desperate for him to take over. Henry captured Robert at the Battle of Tinchebrai in September and put him in prison for the rest of his exceptionally long life. He died in Cardiff Castle in 1134, well into his 80s. William the Conqueror fathered his sons in reverse order of regal competence. If this isn't enough to make me endorse porphyrogeniture, it's still a massive rubdown for primogeniture. I wonder how it felt to witness it at the time. Our notions of meritocracy and equality of opportunity would have sounded incomprehensible to medieval ears, and not just because there was nothing they could do about the build-up of wax. Kings were chosen by God and anointed by bishops. The way God chose them was to make them born to the previous king. But did people not reflect on the obvious fact that Henry was really good at the job and Robert was terrible, and the other fact that the only way Henry got to be king ahead of Robert was via theft and violence? Did it not make them wonder about their system for running things? I feel sorry for Curtos, though, living out long decades in prison, just a 5-minute walk from Wales's only branch of the Ivy, though counterintuitively a 985-year walk would have been more convenient, because that's how long he'd have to wait before it would open. I doubt there was even a chip shop back in his day, as it was centuries before the first potatoes arrived in Europe. Still, he wouldn't have been able to afford a meal anyway. Poor guy. Remembered to this day by the condescending nickname his father gave him. It sometimes feels like they're set up to fail, these eldest sons of powerful men. There's something in the arrogance, the need to feel indispensable, and the fear of death of guys like William the Conqueror that makes it impossible for them not to be disappointed with their heirs. Their own toxic mixture of self-loathing and narcissism stews inside them and comes out as contempt for their firstborn. "This boy has my failings but will never learn to overcome them like I have," is often the sentiment. With younger sons, there seems to be more space for love, but the eldest is presumed to be trying to supplant the father and gets blamed for mortality itself. It feels like Curtos's failure to get his shit together was made inevitable by his father's low expectations. The younger sons were free to be themselves. Robert Curtos's own son was also free to be himself. Known as William Clito, Clito being a medieval Latin word meaning royal or princely,